Hello and welcome to The Wire, your independent national coverage of current affairs right across Australia on community and Indigenous radio. I'm Emi Nishikura coming to you from 4EB in Melbourne, Victoria. And today on the show...
What was the ensuing chaos? There were, you know, hundreds of people running and screaming and, you know, reacting as you would expect from a bomb having gone off and...
20 years on from the Bali bombings, a survivor shares his story with The Wire.
Potentially all of the strip searches that police have conducted over many years are or have been unlawful.
New South Wales police found guilty in historic strip search class action case. And later today...
If you have a hip fracture, it's just routine process that you go to rehab. But if you have cancer... Because it is a newer area, it just doesn't happen.
Cancer rehab grows in Australia. We look at why access issues still persist. We'll have this and more for you over the next half hour. 20 years ago, bombs detonated across Bali in Indonesia, where 20 people were killed and 129 were injured in a series of attacks in the Indonesian island. A Newcastle-based survivor of the bombings has created a podcast looking into the motivations of the killers and the stories of the survivors. Joe Frost was just a few feet away from one of the bombs when it detonated. The Wire's contributor from 2NUR FM's Peter Hislop spoke to Joe Frost about his story.
I always knew what had happened to me, and I suppose I had a fairly good outline of what had happened to the rest of our group from Newcastle on that night. But it was only a few years ago that I started to process how much bigger this whole thing was, that, you know, three suicide bombers attacked in coordination, and something like that doesn't just happen. It needs an enormous level of coordination and not just coordination, but like creating bombs, you know, like there's know-how involved in that. You know, the internet isn't what it is today in 2005. It wasn't something you could just Google. So who taught these people how to make the bombs? And the people that did it had been on the run, you know, they were wanted men. So who was putting them up? You know, how were they managing to evade the law? How were they buying their meals? You know, like just the money that's required just to live your life day to day. This whole thing, it was so much bigger than I had ever really aimed to process, I suppose, is the way to put it. And when I started to ask those really, I guess, basic questions, it started to lead to some very complex answers. And the more that I asked, the more I realized I didn't know, and therefore I didn't get answers. I just got better questions to ask.
I guess one thing I did want to ask is what you remember and some of the first things that you remember experiencing after the blast.
So there were two bombs on the beach, and the first bomb went off to the north of the table that I was sitting at, which was to my left. So I was just looking to the left at what was the ensuing chaos. There were, you know, hundreds of people running and screaming and, you know, reacting as you would expect from a bomb having gone off. And I don't know why, but I just sort of thought, oh, well, you know, our bomb has gone off. I guess that's that. And I was scared, but I just thought it was over. You know, and it wasn't. And then the next thing I knew, I was face down in the sand and my ears were ringing and my legs were burning. And I think, as I've said before, that the chaos came to us.
I guess this disaster it kind of plays second fiddle to the 2002 disaster. And you've mentioned this and it's a lot harder to find information. I guess that would have been really frustrating and concerning for families, particularly at the time.
I suppose at the time, you know, it's all over the papers and it was a big story then. But by the time you're sort of talking 15, 20 years later, when I started to do research for the podcast, you know, you Google Bali 2005 and you get sent to pages about the 2002 Bali bombing. I remember one of the first searches I did on ChatGPT, I said, tell me about the 2005 Bali bombing. And it said, well, the 2005 Bali bombing happened in 2002 and told me all about the 2002 Bali bombing. And I'm, you know, found that it was just sort of happening over and over again. So initially, it was very frustrating that that had, I suppose, overshadowed this other event. But then I started to think, well, if the story's not been told, well, then there's an opportunity for me to tell it. And as I say, I started to ask questions, and that led me to people who had answers, and that led me to more people who had more answers. And as I dug deeper, I initially had thought that this was a story that people had forgotten, but I came to understand that it was a story that people didn't know.
for sure. And a lot of people in Newcastle, of course, were affected by this. And, you know, new people that had died in this disaster, I guess. There's this memorial coming up on Wednesday, of course. There'd be a lot of people affected by this. And I'd imagine it'd be a fairly emotional event.
Yeah, it's, as you say, a lot of people from Newcastle were involved. There were 18 of us from Newcastle on the beach. 15 of us survived the event. And within that, most of the people who were on the beach from Newcastle were parents. So there were another sort of 30 or so of people back at the hotel that were largely a group of high school kids and even some primary school kids. So, you know, I think it's easy to think, oh, you know, how does it affect the people who were there on the beach and the people that survived the blast itself? But it wasn't until years later that I started to process, like, you know, there was a 10-year-old boy there, you know, and he was technically safe the whole time, but how scared he must have been and how that must have been such a formative event for him.
You mentioned you've done this this big investigation, you've done this podcast. I guess, has finding out some more information about the killers and their motivations, I guess, broadly put you at more peace about what happened, or kind of made you feel more, not at ease, but I guess just, yeah, feeling more a bit of closure maybe in regards to what happened that day?
It's a tricky one because I don't think there ever is closure with something like this. And I have been asked by a few people why I did it. And I guess because it was there. It's always going to be there. And it was a bit of a black box. There was just this thing that happened and it was horrible and it was really, really formative in my life. And it was only in the last few years that I started to process that I hadn't processed it, that I didn't know what happened.
Podcast creator Joe Frost there speaking with 2NUR FM's Peter Hislop. In 2018, Raya Meredith went to a music festival and experienced a unlawful strip search by the New South Wales Police. A male officer conducted the search, leaving Miss Meredith vulnerable. However, she decided to take legal proceedings against the police. The case has become a class act led by Slater and Gordon and the Red Fern Legal Centre, being the largest class action against any police force in Australian history. Today, the New South Wales Supreme Court awarded significant damages to Miss Meredith and finding strip searching unlawful. The Supreme Court has also found out the New South Wales Police's training conducting searches were inadequate. The Wise Eduardo Jordan asked Supervising Solicitor at Redfern Legal Centre, Samantha Lee, to explain more about the case and what this win means.
Raya was attending a music festival and was pulled out of the line due to a drug dog indication. And she was taken from that indication to a kind of make-do cubicle and asked to take off all of her clothes and to squat. And she was wearing a tampon at the time and to partly remove that tampon. As this was happening, a male police officer walked by and gave her bag back to the other officer who was conducting the strip search. There was nothing found on her, but she was obviously extremely traumatised by the experience, and she has been the lead plaintiff in this class action.
So what does this mean for young people at festivals in a similar situation?
Well, what this judgment means is really that potentially all of the strip searches that police have conducted over many years are or have been unlawful. The judgment that came down today has clearly stated that there's a very high bar that police need to meet to conduct a strip search, and that high bar hasn't been met in these circumstances. So in this case, the lead plaintiff was awarded near to $100,000, and there will be awards of money given out to those who have registered for the class action, which is around 3,000. It could move up to around 6,000 people.
Now, what were the main concerns regarding, in this case, regarding the New South Wales Police's tactics on strip searching young people?
Well, as Justice Yehia said, it became routine. It just morphed into a general search, which is not how Parliament intended this legislation to act out. Parliament intended for a strip search to be only conducted in very exceptional circumstances. Instead, we've seen thousands of strip searches being conducted per year in New South Wales, which is just not how the law is meant to operate on the ground.
Now, so after handing this decision down, you mentioned that this was a class action. What's next in the process?
The next stage is for the parties to work out the damages for the class members. We know that the lead plaintiff has been awarded near $100,000, but need to work out for the other plaintiffs the damages. An important part of this action is that the judge awarded what's called exemplary damages, and what that damage sends out to the state is only awarded to punish the state for a systemic failing towards the people of New South Wales. So it's really important that the judge did award exemplary damages in this case.
I'm guessing there will be more young people coming into this class action. Where can they get more information about this?
Yeah, so people can still register for the class action. Either go to our website, Redfern Legal Centre, or to Slater and Gordon's website. We are also looking at moving forward with Slater and Gordon, whether there's a potential for claims for those who were strip searched from 2023 onwards as well. This action has been powered by the courage of young people. The government did not stand up for them, so they stood up for themselves, and today they have been awarded for their courage.
That was Samantha Lee from Redfern Legal Centre speaking with The Wire's Eduardo Jordan. You're listening to The Wire, independent current affairs on Community and Indigenous Radio. I'm Amina Shakur in Melbourne. A big hello to our listeners in Alice Springs on 8CCC 102.1 FM. And to our friends in Noosa on Noosa FM 101.3. And to the other side of the country to Radio Goolari in Broome, Western Australia. Cancer rehab programs in Australia have more than doubled in the last 10 years, but many survivors still can't get the help they need. La Trobe University researchers say rehab that includes exercise can boost quality of life. However, issues like poor funding, limited access, and inconsistent referrals are holding people back. Here's Dr. Amy Dennett from La Trobe University sharing her thoughts on cancer rehab.
It's a real multifaceted problem, but I think to sum it up, it's probably that exercise is not being prioritised as a key part of cancer care, even though guidelines strongly recommend exercise is integrated into people's care. So this then flows down into specialists not having discussions about exercise and cancer, and part of that is around them maybe not knowing what advice to give or not knowing where they can refer people to get the right advice, but also it flows into funding as well. So exercise rehab is not being prioritised in health services as being a core part of rehabilitation programs. So for example, to compare it with other diseases, in heart disease, if you have a heart attack, it's prioritised and known that you then get a referral to cardiac rehab. And if you have a hip fracture, it's just routine process that you go to rehab. But if you have cancer, because it is a newer area, it just doesn't happen. And we don't have the same level of information from a health economics point of view, that people who have that power to allow funding for these programs to be established. So I think it's a bit of a combination, but I think we need to switch our thinking about exercise being a very important part of cancer recovery. It's not just a nice to have, it's a need to have. And therefore, we need to invest money into it so we can then provide the programs and have the discussions that we need to have.
Your research found that exercise is like the one of the most powerful tools for recovery. So how does exercise change the patient's life?
So exercise can have a huge impact on someone's quality of life and can really make a difference when people are receiving treatment, even before they even have treatment, getting them prepared for surgery so they can have a better outcome after their surgery or after their chemotherapy. And we have irrefutable evidence, so lots and lots of research that says exercise can help support reducing side effects. So particularly things like cancer-related fatigue, which most people will have at some point in time, and is one of the most debilitating side effects of cancer treatment. Exercise can actually counter that and help people be more active and do the things that they want to be able to do sooner, even if they have had quite intensive treatment. It also helps improve their mood and prevents people from being as isolated during their cancer experience because it connects them with other cancer survivors potentially. But one of the most important things that we now have evidence from a large trial that was done this year is that exercise can even impact cancer, the fact that it can return. So we know that we can reduce cancer recurrence and reduce the risk of early death from cancer by up to 37%, which is as high as some chemotherapy drugs. So we really have strong evidence that there's the patient-related outcomes and their experience, but there's also these direct cancer outcomes that potentially exercise can impact. So exercise in conjunction to your treatment can help you live longer and stop the cancer coming back.
And the lack of funding is a big challenge. So what does that mean in practice for the survivors trying to get support?
So it just simply means that there's not the programs available for people to access, particularly in public health services. So we know that people with cancer, it's hard enough to exercise anyway if you don't have any chronic health condition. Yet if you put cancer on top of that, you really do need some specialised support from a physiotherapist or an exercise physiologist so people can be guided to do it safely. And sometimes the best place to do that is within a supported hospital setting where people are getting their cancer treatment. So if we had more funding, we could have these exercise professionals in the places where people are receiving treatment to make it easier for them to get started on that journey and support them to be active, whether it be before, during, or after cancer treatment, and then set them up for long-term health outcomes. So really, if we had more funding, we would have more people who are qualified to be able to provide the real specialized support that these people need.
Yeah, and more programs are now offering like telehealth services. How will that change the experience for the cancer patients, especially like those in regional areas?
Yeah, so it certainly has improved access to a certain extent of people to be able to exercise in those areas, because many of those people that live in rural and regional areas, we know that health professionals don't necessarily have conversations with them about exercise because they know that exercise services are not in their area. So they think, well, why bother? But now they can tap into some of these supports that are at the larger hospitals. So for example, where I work at Eastern Health, we are a very large geographical area that has metropolitan sites, but we also have some outer eastern regional sites. And we now have a telehealth program that people from Warburton, Yarra Valley, they can all tap into our expert support that usually is only delivered at Wantirna. So it certainly offers the flexibility and convenience to a cohort of patients that might not have otherwise had any access to exercise.
That was Dr. Amy Dennett from La Trobe University speaking with The Wire's Yan Wang. New research have found that there's not enough representation of individuals living with disability in children's books. The study conducted by ECU assessed 90 award-listed children's books, finding depiction of disabled characters was virtually non-existent. The Wire's contributor from RTR-FM, Fiona Bartholomew, spoke with Associate Professor at the ECU's School of Education, Helen Adam, to discuss the study further.
Picture books especially are among children's first encounters with literature. So this is really important. What they encounter in picture books from a very young age plays a big role in shaping their very early worldviews. And there's a lot of research that shows children's identities, attitudes to people of different races and different to themselves, as well as their own sense of self. These things are largely fixed by the end of, say, primary school, and they certainly start forming from a very, very young age. So books play a really important role in serving as it's a lovely image used by one of the most important scholars in this field, and it's the concept of mirrors and windows, so that books reflect to children their own experiences, their own life, their own backgrounds, and they also act as windows showing other worlds and other experiences. So when you have kids that are completely absent and don't see themselves, that plays a really important role in those particular children. But also, if you're not seeing diversity reflected in the books you read, then that, you know, can reaffirm able-bodied, cisgendered white children's perspectives of a sense of I'm normal and anyone who's different to me is not. So there is a real educational function here, and there's also a very ideological influence. So bottom line there is that picture books profoundly shape how children understand themselves and others in those critical developmental years, which makes representational gaps particularly, you know, potentially harmful.
So tell us more about this research. How did you assess disability representations within all of these picture books?
Right. So, and this is, I'm glad you asked that, because it's always important to remember that researchers are, you know, we're naturally curious and critical. And so we particularly looked for visual representation. So in this particular study, we weren't looking so much at neurodiversity within these books. We were looking at the visual representation of ability and disability. And the main reason for that is we were looking at books aimed at very young children, and for very young children, the pictures often contain more of the meaning. They're looking at the pictures trying to make sense of the story.
It's interesting to hear that only one of the books that you assessed had a representation of disability. I feel like as a collective, we often think that we're getting better in terms of representation within media. So it's quite interesting to hear that result from you.
Yeah, look, I've had this conversation a number of times when I've talked about cultural and racial diversity and even gender diversity. If you look at visual media, for example, you know, on maybe kids' TV shows, certainly the advertising industry is a lot more aware of this. And if you look at ads for, you know, some of the clothing stores, you'll now quite often see kids that do have disabilities that are represented in these. So I think we are in a very important time of shift where there is this recognition, recognition in society and in the media of the importance of representing diversity, what that means, and ultimately, of course, in marketing, what it means for sales, etc. And so it is happening in books. You know, I don't want to say it's not happening at all. It is. But I think books often, for kids, often lag behind where things are in a more general societal sense. So I think it's kind of a last frontier in a way. And it also, you know, I'm not a children's author, okay? I know lots of children's authors. I'm related to one very popular children's author, and it is very complex for authors to research and write about experiences. They care very, very much about speaking to children, speaking through their characters. So it's not a simple matter of someone going, I'm going to write a story about a child with a disability. Often authors need to have that lived experience and that deep understanding in order to represent these things in authentic ways that don't come across as stereotypical or a deficit kind of perspective. So it is a very challenging area for authors and illustrators as well.
Associate Professor at Edith Cowan University, Helen Adam, speaking with RTR FM's Fiona Bartholomew. And unfortunately, that is the end of today's show. Thanks so much for listening wherever you are in Australia. The Wire is a co-production between community radio stations 2SER in Sydney, Radio Adelaide 4ZZZ and Radio 4EB in Brisbane. With the great support of the Community Broadcasting Foundation and Community Radio Network. Check out all of our stories on our website at thewire.org.au and follow us on Instagram, Facebook, X and LinkedIn. The Wire acknowledges the traditional custodians of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation where this program has been produced, and we pay our respects to Aboriginal elders past, present and emerging. I'm Amina Shakira, coming to you from 4EB in Melbourne, Victoria. Thanks so much for your company, and we'll see you next time on The Wire.